That takes us to item five, which is our review of private equity. And Tim, I guess you're going to kick that off, and then we've got...
Yeah, we'll just have Brian come up.
Brian's up.
You know, it's been another active year for us within the private equity space. Made several commitments. I think, you know, the notable thing, and Brian will touch on this, is after a long absence from infrastructure slash real assets funds, we, you know, really the end of last year, we started to pick that pace up again. We're finding more interesting opportunity sets there, and then continuing to plow ahead on private equity. So we're maintaining our pacing. You know, even in a muted environment of the overall marketplace, we're finding unique opportunity sets there. I'm going to turn it over to Brian to talk about what we actually accomplished over the last 12 months and kind of what the forward calendar looks like.
Thank you, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning, members of the board. Get this presentation up here. We are going to go through, we're excited to go through our annual private equity review. I'm happy to have the folks from StepStone here. But we're going to start out just with a, like Tim mentioned, just a review on our, basically our total portfolio here in private equity and what we accomplished in sort of this calendar year. We'll go through the equity program, the strategy, and then some key takeaways. Just as a refresher, and basically what you just heard from Mitch, you know, private equity and then also infrastructure resides within that growth portfolio. We're looking for return generation out of these two asset classes. The participants within our private equity program, obviously it's Sisera, manage the private equity program. It's top-down strategy selection, bottom-up investment manager evaluations, and then monitoring those investment managers. We also have our general partners who are extremely important, but they're tasked with just source, evaluating, and executing on managing the private equity investments. And then we have StepStone providing advice, resources to Sisera on private equity, responsible for pacing analysis, portfolio monitoring, reporting. We have a really good dialogue with StepStone on an ongoing basis just to talk about the markets and private equity and really how we want to continue to develop our program. The strategy, it's really a sort of a top-down, bottom-up type of strategy, but we'll start with the investment pacing plan, which StepStone will get into in their presentation. But we take a broad look at the economic outlook, different geographies and sectors within private markets. And then we really want to find those strategies and managers that are the best fit for Sisera. So not all managers fit what we're trying to accomplish in our portfolio. So it's that really intersection of that top down and bottom up that we're really trying to prioritize as we go out and diligence general partners. The opportunity set that we have identified for our private equity strategy, and really as we go into 2025, and it's really almost a repeat of 2024. On the geography standpoint, we are North America focused, North America centric in our private equity allocation, but have gone into Europe and made some a couple really key commitments this year that we'll talk about to sort of diversify our exposure away from North America into Europe. Sectors, it's across all sectors, but I would say IT, industrials, healthcare have been really keys to us, as well as financial services. The implementation is primarily with primary funds, and then our strategies are buyouts, and we're really starting to take a look at that growth equity market. In 2024, the activity that we have, we'll start with just our fund-to-funds. So we've been really focused on our direct allocations, you know, since really 2018. But we have a good amount in our fund-to-funds. As you can see, we have 6 fund-to-fund relationships. The bottom asterisk there shows that we, as of June, we had about $720 million that was invested with these fund-to-fund managers. We did a deep dive on the fund of funds, spending January and February, did a lot of virtual calls with all the managers. Just got updates and cash flow projections. And then we went in person and did on-site visits with all the groups, talked to the teams, business development, operations, and cash flows. It's been great having these fund-to-funds, the fund-to-fund allocation over the last several years. And as you can see, we really wanted to highlight the distributions that we've been receiving back from these managers. Through September, we had received almost $110 million in distributions back from our fund-to-fund managers. And importantly, the capital calls are pretty negligible, if really anything, on a lot of these strategies right now. So it's a lot of cash flow coming back. But just for the board's comfort, just know that staff's continuing to monitor these relationships on a day-to-day basis.
One of the reasons why we're getting out of fund-to-fund is the fee structure.
Correct.
There's a double layer of fees because we're paying the fund-to-fund manager, and
on
then we're also paying the underlying managers that the fund-to-fund manager selects. So there's a double layer of fee there. And we think over time that the direct investments that we're making in private equity should be better returning investments than the fund-to-fund portfolio. And I think StepStone will highlight some of that.
Is there any difference in the ability to with respect to exits with fund-to-funds versus direct? I mean, if you buy fund-to-funds and they have multiple funds underneath them, do you rely on their ability to exit on this one GP versus somebody else?
No,
I mean, is it all
one? Really, the fund-to-fund manager really does not have any discretion on any type of exits. They're relying completely on the underlying general partner. So whenever the general partner makes exits and distributes back to that fund-to-fund manager, who then subsequently distributes back to us, you know, the fund-to-fund manager is just really in a wait mode right now.
Okay.
I also have a question. On this page, the
the other one.
All right. $110 million. Is it just for year 24?
That's just calendar year. That's January 1st, 2024 to September 30th, 2024. So just that nine-month period of time, we received almost $110 million back.
On $700 million investment, right? So it's like 14% just in 9 months.
And the current value of those fund-to-funds as of June was a total $720 million that's been invested.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'd take that.
Yeah, we like that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And part of the mindset is to you get those distributions and you parlay those into newer investments.
Right? Yeah. So, perfect segue into the next slide here, our actual commitments into the direct. So it's almost like they're self-funding themselves in a way. We're getting the distributions back from existing general partners, and then we're using that capital to actually fund new investments. 2024 was an active year. We committed roughly $305 million. To put that into context, in 2023, we did $415 million in commitments. In 2023, it was three re-ups, so existing managers that had come back with their new funds, and then there was two new relationships that we invested with in 2023. So roughly $415 million. In 2024, the activity was $305 million. You can see above there, we went into Europe. You can see the European commitments that we made, Altor, energy transition in Europe. Blackfin Financial is focused on financial services in Europe. And then Castic is more of a diversified manager across some different sectors all within Europe. And then we're actually diligencing and about to wrap up a re-up. That's the fund under review right now. So $305 million in 2024, a lot lighter than in 2023. But I think the most important takeaway here is, although we're underweight private equity, we're not going to force capital out on an annual basis. We're only going to invest if we find high-quality general partners to invest with. In 2023, there was a little bit more opportunity. We found a little bit higher quality general partner and committed a little over $400 million. This year was $300 million. We're not upset or concerned about that. We want to only focus on those very, very high quality general partners.
When you make the commitments, that locks up the capital, right? And so, but you just, in order for that capital to be working, it has to be deployed.
It has to be deployed.
So is there a thought of looking into the investments? What's the chance that those funds will be deployed? Because if you commit it, you're still locking up those funds. You've made a promise, right?
Yeah.
You can't commit $400 million and then pretend like, well, they've only deployed $200 million, so you got $200 million to work with. That's real.
That's a real commitment. We expect it to be drawn down and invested. But, you know, only time will tell how much actually gets deployed. Because I think also importantly, the managers are not going to just deploy for because they have money. Right. They still want to protect.
You want the deployment to be meaningful.
Exactly.
But the amount that's committed but not deployed, what happens to those funds? Does that go into a how does that earn revenue?
So what we basically do is say, you know, the board has authorized 15% private equity. We're at 10% today. That 5% differential is then redeployed back into public markets. And so you recall the implementation plan we presented to the board, I think in August or September, basically said your long-term goal for public equity is here, but because there's undeployed capital, we're going to have a temporarily higher public equity mandate because that's the closest corollary to the private equity. And then as we adjust that going forward as the dollars get deployed. So the money's not in cash. The money's not, you know, sitting idly by. It's always deployed into the closest corollary in the public markets. And then we just adjust those on a going forward basis.
And then so if they do get called, then you've got it in a liquid vehicle that can be cashed out and then moved over to.
And I think this slide, you know, illustrates also the initial sort of push into that infrastructure asset class. As Tim mentioned, Altor Act is going to fit within that infrastructure, energy transition, climate transition. And in 2023, we made a good-sized commitment to EQT's infrastructure fund, very large, diversified infrastructure manager and fund that we committed to in 2023. So we're starting to build up that infrastructure allocation as well. And StepStone has an actual pacing model just for our infrastructure asset class this year. And then to look at 2025, you know, I'd say it's the same of what we've been trying to do. Identify high quality general partners, build relationships with them, and make commitments. In 2025, what we're sort of projecting at this point in time is we anticipate a couple of our existing general partners to come to launch their next fund. One to two that we think right now will be in position to sort of launch their next fund. And really just continued sourcing of those new relationships. You know, just really talking to a lot of general partners, really trying to identify the best fits for our portfolio. And then StepStone will get into the projected pacing commitment for 2025 a bit more, but just as a summary in private equity, the range is between 340 and 510 million. Infrastructure is between 60 and 90 million. In potential pacing for 2025. And that really concludes all my comments. You know, we're trying to really be consistent and disciplined on the pacing, but like I said, not trying to force money out for the sake of forcing money out. It's a multi-year approach, and, you know, it's a lot of fun, and we enjoy it quite a bit. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Stepstone for some more detail on our portfolio.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Great. Tom, Natalie, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. It's good to be back here. It's been a few years. I'm going to run through an overview of the market, maybe cover some areas that Mitch didn't cover, and then turn it over to Natalie to talk more specifically about pacing and performance. Sorry about my picture there. So this is a bit of an eye chart. I'm not going to go through it word by word, but just to set kind of a high level, past 3 years have been pretty poor for distributions. General partners have basically been sitting on assets waiting for valuations to recover. So there hasn't really been a lot of cash flow coming. We're starting to see some green shoots that's starting to improve, and we'll talk a little bit about what's driving that. Essentially, credit markets are becoming more accommodative. I think we've seen some particularly low distributions because of the election, with the anticipation of a more supportive regulatory environment. We think that's going to spark some additional deal flow. But it's also just been a long time, so there's a lot of assets that are ready to change hands. The small buyout market has been a bright spot in the private markets. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then co-investment activity has picked up. And so we see a lot of LPs and GPs spending more time on co-investments. We'll talk a little bit about that.
Tom, hold on a second. I think we have a question from...
Just on number one, could you... The last paragraph, can you expand on what there continues to be meaningful processes that end up broken? What does that mean?
So essentially you have a seller who thinks about their asset as being worth $100. When interest rates go up or there's higher uncertainty, buyers maybe are only willing to pay $75. So you have that bid-ask spread. And the negotiation is about how to try to bridge that bid-ask spread so you can get to a transaction. That bridge has been very difficult to build over the past few years. And credit markets are an important part of that, can help provide the kind of grease to get those processes going. Credit markets have been improving, but they're not fully accommodative yet. And so processes will get going, but then for various reasons, you aren't able to build that bridge between the bid-ask spread. And so they're not closing. The green shoot, is that those processes are at least, people are trying to bridge the gap. 2 years ago, nobody was even trying to bridge the gap. So we're sort of in that middle phase where people are trying to make things happen. The spreads have narrowed a little bit. We think next year, more of those processes will come to a conclusion.
So let me follow on that. So I read that the private credit facilities have played a greater role in trying to bridge that. Are traditional lenders really declining in importance in this area relative to private?
Yeah, the credit markets have changed a lot. So traditionally, these processes would be fueled by syndicated loans. The syndicated loan market is a little bit different than the direct lending market. It's insurance companies, it's institutional investors participating in loans originated by mainly banks. That syndicated loan market in 2022, with the rise in interest rates, kind of went away. It's starting to come back in 2024. It looks like it's going to be healthier in 2025. And we've got a couple of slides to talk a little bit about that part of the market. The direct lending part of the market actually took advantage of that kind of vacuum and expanded a bit into larger transactions. With what's going on, a lot of regional banks have retrenched from lending because of their exposure to commercial real estate. And so direct lending has found opportunity there as well.
So we have the ability to walk down the hall to our private credit department, right? And there's some synergy, or should be, right? Is that fair?
Well, I mean, we're in both private credit and private equity. So, of course, we think that there's great synergy across all these private asset classes. So I'm a little bit of a – my credibility maybe on that is maybe a little tainted.
Well, you have a lens on it. That's for sure. Okay.
Well, I think it does go to the second point there, where you have seen more activity on the smaller side of the market, where direct lending is more dominant, where the non-bank lender is more dominant. There's been more activity there, and certainly we've seen that on our legacy fund-to-fund side, where you saw the Sigular Guff having a great year for distributions. That's small and middle market buyouts on a fund-to-funds basis. Activity still happening there. What we're seeing is a stall out at the top. So if you have a great company that you've built up and you've held it for 7 or 8 years, and the IPO market's not very robust, and you know the bank lending market's not very robust, those are kind of stalled out. You have a great company, there's just not a great ecosystem around it to transact. That's kind of where we want to focus on. You know, are there green shoots on that front?
Okay.
So this is showing you the fundraising for private equity over the past 15 years or so. There's been some recovery in the fundraising, but as you can see, it's down quite significantly from 2021. Essentially, the fundraising is becoming easier for the more attractive managers. So we're finding they're coming in and out of the market faster. The less attractive managers are still taking a long time to raise. In a really accommodative fundraising market, even the less attractive managers are raising relatively quickly. On the venture and growth side, we haven't seen as much of a recovery in fundraising there, and we think that'll take a little while to adjust. This is showing the growth or decline in distribution activity year over year. I won't belabor that. I'll probably spend more time on this slide, which shows distributions, and we can compare the dot-com bust in 2001 and 2002 on the left side of this page, the global financial crisis in 08 and 09, and then our current, whatever we're calling this, you know, post-COVID increase in interest rates. We're in our third year of a decline in distribution activity. So it's actually longer than the two prior cycles that we've seen. Like I said, we are starting to see some green shoots that's going to change. You can see the distribution activity from your fund to funds is actually higher than what the overall market has seen, which may be a function of them just being more mature than the market is on average. I talked about small buyouts being more attractive. This is showing the distribution of multiples for exits. The top bar shows the small market. The bottom bar shows the larger end of the market. As you can see, there are fewer dark blue transactions in the distribution and more light green transactions. So that's a pretty good mix relative to the larger end of the market. So you know, that smaller and middle market buyout has been a more attractive place to be over the past few years. This is a dry powder slide. People talk a lot about dry powder. That's capital that's waiting to be deployed. And as you can see, it's grown a lot over the past 20 years or so. I like to look more at the green line, which is the ratio of the dry powder to the total net asset value, or you know, how much portfolio there is to sustain out there. So if you think about your own private equity portfolio, you need a certain amount of undrawn commitments to sustain your target level of assets in your portfolio. So the overall market is the same way. So the amount of pressure on prices is really a function of the relationship between how much dry powder there is and how much assets there are to manage. And so what you can see here, the green line is actually lower than it's been for most of the last 20 years. So I think that is an encouraging, even though the absolute number has grown a lot, it's supporting a much more larger base of assets. And so we don't think that it's going to drive excess prices. This is looking at the valuation environment. As you can see, valuations have climbed. It's a little bit misleading. I think the mix of the types of transactions that have been happening in the last 3 years is different than what has happened in the prior 10 years. So only the best companies are selling in this environment. And so those companies are actually going to have higher multiples because they have strong cash flow. They are growing fast. So you would expect that. So this is really, you're looking at sort of the deals that are getting done are the top 25 or 30% of a traditional distribution of companies. So it's more of a mix shift, a quality shift that's driving the increase in multiples than sort of an overall observation of the valuations in the market. I think the other interesting thing here is you can see the difference between, on the left-hand side, value-oriented industries versus premium. A premium industry would be, say, IT, financial services, healthcare. They're getting much higher multiples. They tend to be faster growing, lower CapEx. The more value-oriented industries, the multiples are significantly lower. On the right-hand side, you can see the difference between the large end and the small end. One of the reasons why the small end has been a good place to be is you can buy companies at much lower valuations, and that gives you more degrees of freedom to be able to do something with the company and then sell it on as it grows at a higher multiple. Leverage multiples, you can see there's a big difference between small and large on the right-hand side of this page as well. They're recovering a bit. It's a function of the credit markets, which I'll talk about here in a second. So credit markets, this is showing more of the syndicated loan market. You can see that on the right-hand side, the new issues in 2024 have been much higher, so the syndicated loan market has recovered substantially. On the right-hand side, you can see that in the corporate market, which is different than what we see in the real estate market, you don't have an impending wall of maturities where assets need to be refinanced. So the credit markets are not going to drive a need for companies to sell themselves. So you're not going to have fire sales. GPs really have set up capital structures that's going to allow them to wait for the price that they want, which is a good place to be. Mitch talked a little bit about the left-hand side of this page with rates starting to come down. The right-hand side, he hinted at a little bit. So you can see that spreads in the direct lending market have come down fairly substantially in the past year. So that tells us that lenders are, the market is becoming more competitive. So there's more deals, there's more lenders out there competing for those deals. So we think on the private equity side, getting deals done, that is an attractive feature. It's actually attractive also on the private credit side. And the reason I think it's attractive there is you're going to actually see more deployment. So private credit has had great gross yields, but there hasn't been very many deals getting done. So you haven't been able to deploy as much capital as you might like. So we're sort of, I think, on the private credit side, searing into more of a Goldilocks kind of an environment where even though we expect SOFR to come down 50 or 100 basis points and spreads are going to compress a little bit, you're going to be able to deploy more capital and you're still going to be making 9, 10, 11%. So we think it's still an attractive environment, perhaps an even more attractive environment in terms of being able to get more dollars to work.
I don't know. I'm just reacting. There seems to be a disconnect, though. The credit facilities have expanded, right? So you've had much more favorable conditions. I remember 4 or 5 years ago listening about the tightening of covenants, and or maybe it was a little longer than that, but the tightening of covenants, things have got very restrictive, and then we went to covenant light, and now we're in a more favorable environment, and yet there's still the spread, right? You have the unwilling buyer. The willing seller here and the unwilling buyer here. So what? How do you bridge that gap? That's maybe a dumb question, but.
Well, I think the three bullets on the first slide kind of all are interrelated. So if you think about, the distributions coming down, that's effectively companies being exited or limited transactions happening, right?
Yeah.
And so where are the transactions happening? They're happening at the lower end of the market where there's less leverage. And then kind of the third point is, so if less leverage is being used, then where are the deals that are getting done getting the equity? And it's from limited partners or co-investors. So you're seeing higher equity participation, less debt participation, just given how high interest rates have been. But with interest rates coming down, we expect more credit to kind of be the stopgap between the equity and the debt.
So the outlook is favorable, maybe.
I think it's favorable. I think rates are going to come down on the short end. Spreads are going to come down, but the combination is still going to be good. And there's going to be a lot more deals getting done, so you're going to be able to deploy more capital. So the dollars that you're going to earn from that strategy should actually increase, even though the sort of profitability seems to be lower. It's because you're going to be able to deploy more capital.
Okay. And so there's also a concern of investors flooding into that space with private credit. And will that dilute returns? But my understanding is the demand for such available credit is just way up there compared to what is being utilized now. Are you less fearful of that dilution concern with private credit returns?
I think the dilution risk was higher when there was less capital being deployed in the private credit space. So if we go back to this slide, distributions is a proxy for the amount of deals that are getting done. And so if there are fewer deals getting done, then there's fewer new private credit loans going out. And so if you have more people flooding in with dollars and less deal flow, that could be bad for pricing. However, what we saw on this other slide is that spreads were actually pretty healthy. So we've shifted, you had a pretty strong bias in 2023 towards, SOFR plus 600, which is a pretty high spread. That pricing has moved down into, more the 500 to 600 zip code, which is still a pretty healthy spread over SOFR, which is, 4.5% or whatever. I think what you would see if there was too much capital flooding in is those spreads would actually have compressed a lot more than they have. They've compressed a bit because the deal flow hasn't picked up yet. I don't think they're going to compress a lot more because I think the deal flow is going to start to pick up. The second thing that has absorbed more capital is because direct lending, it used to be they could only do facilities lower than $500 million. And so they really concentrated on a very small end of the market. They're now starting to see, $750 billion facilities getting done. So the penetration of direct lending across the types of loans getting done has actually increased, and that's going to allow deployment of more capital. So I don't think we're yet at a place where we need to worry about pricing running away because of a flood of capital. Uh, I'm sorry, this slide just shows an increase in co-investment activity. Really, what's driving that is this slide. Natalie alluded to this. On the left-hand side, you know, the cost of financing is a bit higher, quite a bit higher than it used to be. I think the middle part of this is pretty significant. So the equity contribution in the typical buyout is much higher today than it was even 10 years ago. That increases the amount of equity that needs to go into any individual deal. So GPs are needing to find that additional equity somewhere else, and they're turning to their best customers, typically, who are their LPs. I would say that GPs are managing their portfolios differently than they used to. It used to be a typical position size in a buyout fund would be 8 to 10%. Now a typical position size is like 2 or 3 or 4%. So they've diversified themselves quite a bit inside of the individual funds. That is causing them to look for co-investors more often, even investing in the same size companies. Then finally, fundraising has slowed down a lot. So GPs have been using co-investment strategically to attract LPs to invest in their funds. So it's been kind of a win-win scenario for LPs who are looking to get more exposure to GPs that they already have a relationship with, but at lower fees and carry. And the GPs who want to build stronger relationships with those LPs without necessarily having to cut their headline pricing, so that they can offer this as an incentive to recognize their best customers. So that's a relatively quick spin through the market environment. We see some green shoots, optimism about deal activity happening. There's all the same caveats that Mitch talked about in terms of uncertainty about economic growth, inflation, and so forth. When I think about it from our chair, the uncertainty actually favors private markets. Private markets really make money by being active shareholders and dealing with uncertainty, helping companies transform the business, budget capital efficiently, and identify the right management. And so I think it's an attractive time to have private equity in your portfolio. I think the other thing that private equity does, you talked a lot about diversification. We don't have a situation where we're dominated by just a few companies. So we can add diversification to the portfolio. And private markets tend to be more stable in terms of valuation. So in volatile markets, the private equity portfolio is actually going to be a stabilizer on the overall portfolio.
Great. Maybe diving into the pacing analysis and bridging, what Brian talked about on the forward calendar, as well as how we kind of use our data and research to assist Contra Costa on the process. Here's a snapshot of the private equity pacing. We also this year did a real assets pacing analysis, which is new and based on the new 3% target to that asset class. But starting with private equity, we have increased the target commitments on a go-forward basis. Again, wanting to allow flexibility, so a banded or a range for per annum commitments to private equity funds. We're suggesting increasing from $350 million plus or minus 20% per annum to about an average of $425 million plus or minus 20% per annum, consistent with the ranges that you saw Brian flash up. One of the reasons for the increase in allocation is the total portfolio has grown. So today, now sitting at $12 billion, a high watermark for the Contra Costa total portfolio. And as the total portfolio grows, need to increase the allocation to private equity to keep up with that growth. Of course, the denominator is heavily weighted towards public markets, so we like to be flexible with our dollars and update this analysis annually to make sure that we account for any public market volatility. And then really, you know, the second reason for the increase in total dollars is just kind of allowing the program to grow with the existing managers. And so, as Brian mentioned, you'll see a mix of both existing fund commitments to existing managers as well as net new names. And Brian talked about some of the areas where we're looking to add diversification, whether that's outside the U.S. selectively while still keeping it mostly concentrated in North America, or adding small buyout and or growth equity exposure to the portfolio given some of the trends in the market that we're observing. So again, this is a long-term target. We've undershot here the 15% target, again, to allow for public market volatility and changes year to year and the actual dollars going out, but feel very comfortable with the plan and feel like it's achievable based on the forward calendar. Turning to the real asset pacing, again, this is new and reflects the new 3% target allocation to real assets. So have approximately $75 million budgeted for next year, plus or minus, based on available market opportunities and conditions. And we'll talk a little bit about kind of the strategy in real assets as we get into the next year. That kind of takes us to portfolio performance. So again, kind of marrying everything that Tom said about the market, as well as what Brian said in terms of new commitments. Today we sit at total value of $2.8 billion here, and a market value of just over $1 billion. Important things to highlight on this slide, I know it's a lot of numbers, would just be the year-over-year gain of about $26 million, as well as the net cash flows year-over-year. Again, this is as of June, so reflects June 30, 2024 over June 2023. The total portfolio performance since inception has been around 12% and flat year-over-year. The net cash flows are positive, which is important. That is not the case for most of our clients. We're seeing net new contributions going out faster than distributions coming back to limited partners. So I think this is positive and reflects kind of the legacy portfolio of fund to funds that is longer in the tooth in distribution mode, balanced with kind of the new commitments that you're making and dollars going out over a five-year commitment. Private equity exposure, again, this kind of places a finer point. We've shown this slide in the past over the last couple years just to highlight the transition period that we're in, going from a mostly fund-to-funds portfolio, which is a very passive approach, to a more direct portfolio approach where we're actually selecting direct private equity managers to make asset selections for the plan. And as that transition is ongoing, you'll see the core primary portfolio in green represent a larger position in the total portfolio when fund to funds come down. Again, part of the fund to funds coming down is the distributions coming out off the portfolio. So as those distributions come out, the 32% will decrease year over year. And then private equity performance by sub-portfolio, overall very strong. Since inception, net IRR of 12%. As mentioned this morning, top performing portfolio within the total plan. Total capital committed of around $2.5 billion to 66 private equity funds, but importantly would draw your attention to the kind of core primary fund portfolio of 21 funds today. That's around half of the committed capital. And that exposure is kind of growing year over year. The portfolio performance of the core portfolio is quite strong, sitting at 15% since inception, and really reflects all the investments done on a direct basis since 2017. I'll skip this slide, but we do place a finer point on kind of vintage year performance. And if your eyes are starting to go like mine, I'll just note that, you know, over the last 10 years, the performance has been stronger for the private equity portfolio than the private market equivalent, which would essentially be the public markets. And then private equity performance versus benchmarks. So we have kind of two benchmarks here, the private IQ median, which would be a proxy for investing in a private market index, even though one doesn't exist, and then a public market index, which here we've used the S&P 500. Again, over the 5, 10, and since inception, you've seen that Contra Costa's private equity portfolio has outperformed both private and public markets in some time periods quite substantially. The 10-year is very helpful in measuring kind of private equity performance, since most of the funds are in a 10-year fund life, 14% versus around 9% for the private benchmark and 13% for the public benchmark. Again, public markets have had a very strong year, and that's reflected here in the 1 and even 3-year returns.
Let me interrupt you for a second, Natalie. Asked Tim a question. When we did the benchmark study, I've already forgotten the outcome of that with respect to private equity. Did we adopt a specific benchmark for purposes of this analysis?
For purposes of private markets on an annual basis, no, the board did not adopt specific benchmarks. So this is Stepstone giving us guidance on what is an appropriate set of benchmarks. And this goes to benchmarking private markets being a little bit more of an art than a science. So what the board adopted was, what are we going to look at on a quarterly basis? And that's the, you know, what Verus does, and just, you know, kind of neutralizes the returns of all private markets against themselves. And so this is your once a year look at what are appropriate long-term benchmarks. And this is Stepstone's guidance to you.
So we previously used S&P plus 4%, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what stuck in my mind, is what the old benchmark was.
And that was really kind of the standard benchmark in the 90s, and the market is, as the market has matured, I think, you know, to the extent you're doing that, you're seeing that premium be like S&P plus 1 or 2 in today's market environment. The private market equivalent, which basically says every time there's a cash flow, you know, into or out of a private equity fund, had you traded into or out of the S&P 500, what would your return have been? That's much more finely tuned. And so I think you're looking at a mosaic of benchmarks here, clearly. Is there a premium to the public markets? I mean, we are seeing a premium to the public markets here. Are we doing a good job of implementing versus the entire private equity universe? You can see that we're doing a good job of implementing relative to that private equity universe. But again, you're not going to look at a single benchmark. You're going to have to look at a mosaic of benchmarks for all private markets. And that's just kind of the nature of benchmarking a more difficult asset class.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Didn't mean to interrupt you, but I needed some clarity on that.
With respect to that, I mean, yeah, I would, when I came on to the board, it was the S&P plus 4. It's like you expected a premium for the illiquidity, right? And so it's much less than that. And so is it in part justifiable with respect to private equity that there is, you expect a premium over public markets with respect to return, but then also do you consider a volatility premium with private equity, and how do you measure that? How do you make that meaningful? It just seems more and more as the S&P becomes more and more volatile, and the number of public stocks goes down and the volatility goes up, that there's an attractiveness, not just from returns, but from stability with respect to private markets. So has there been any kind of research or discussion in how you would measure that volatility premium? I mean, there's a sharp ratio and all
that
stuff.
Yeah, that's a very philosophical question. So if you look at the observed volatility of private markets, it's about 8 to 10% versus maybe 20% for the S&P. Now, that's unfair because private equity, you only observe it once a quarter, and you don't really, because you're not selling the stock, it's basically the GP's guess on what the value is, and so it, the returns are much smoother because of that those two facts. I think the returns in the S&P are more volatile than the fundamentals of the underlying companies probably would justify. So, like, sort of the true volatility of both is probably somewhere in between those two. But I think what you're pointing out is a reason why we've seen allocations in private markets continue to rise, even though that benchmark spread from has narrowed from 400 to 1 to 200. Mm-hmm. It's because of that stabilizing impact and the diversification benefit that you get. But not everybody, I notice even in your own capital markets assumptions, you're using a 23% volatility for private equity versus the 8% that you've actually experienced. There's reasons why in asset allocation, the volatilities really matter, and how you deal with that is why I say it's a philosophical question. Without getting into, like, deeper math.
And then, so just turning back to the presentation on the private equity valuation bridge, I think this is a good slide to just talk about on the right-hand side. You know, total distributions at this point since inception have outpaced total contributions. Again, so really kind of playing with house money at this point. The market value today sits at $1.1 billion on top of the $1.7 billion that you've already received in distributions, and cash flows, as we talked about, have been strong in the recent couple years. So on the cash flow analysis, this goes back to 2010, but showing through in the chart, I think, September 2024, the portfolio on an annualized basis this year is cash flow positive. And just taking a look through to the year-end cash flows that we've received, we do expect the portfolio to be net cash flow positive around $15 to $20 million. So again, significant contributions, about $140 million year to date, compared to about $155 million of distributions for calendar 2024, going to be a strong year and increase kind of the total cumulative net cash flow since inception overall. So that green line keeps going up and in the positive. Let's see. Okay, private equity diversification. We track it by strategy and fund type on the right-hand side. Again, just another way of looking at the number of fund of funds versus primary direct commitments, which is the current strategy and secondaries today. On the left-hand side, you can see the strategy really dominated by buyout investments with less exposure to venture capital and growth equity, which represents, you know, about 11% in total today. As Brian mentioned, we're looking at selectively increasing the growth equity allocation off of kind of a couple years of outsized performance. We actually think it's a good time to get into the market, just given that valuations have come down and continue to come down. So when everyone's decreasing valuations, think it might be a good time to potentially add to the portfolio selectively. Within the buyout allocation, we are looking at diversifying in terms of fund size. So when we decided to go direct back in 2017, we really put together over the last couple years a roster of core, large and mid-market kind of best-in-class managers that were established and had long track records. As we sit here today, we think we can add bespoke sector exposure through sector-focused funds, and Brian mentioned a couple of those, whether it's on the financial services side or consumer side. The portfolio already has, as you'll see on this slide, a decent amount of IT, industrials, and healthcare. So we think we can kind of supplement that exposure through leaning into sector-focused funds in a given sector. And then the chart on the left just shows kind of investment by manager, dominated by Adam Street fund-to-fund relationship that has been strong in distributions for the past couple years. And then you can see a couple of your primary relationships really starting to kind of move up on the list of manager exposures. And then maybe last but not least, again, we'll circle back to this in the new year, but just an overall summary of the real assets performance to date. I'd think about this as more of a legacy performance of your portfolio since the couple new infrastructure fund commitments that Brian mentioned, EQT and Altor, have not really made an impact yet since they're starting to call capital today. Over time, the new investments will have a more meaningful impact on the overall infrastructure portfolio performance. And these historical numbers are not necessarily consistent with the types of exposures that we'll look for in real assets going forward, so looking towards kind of higher returning infrastructure funds. With that, maybe I'll pause and open to questions. I think Brian said that it's been fun. I would echo that. We really have enjoyed working with your staff and team and helping them kind of construct a best-in-breed private equity portfolio, and hope to do that next year and come back with an update on 2025.
Any questions for Natalie or Tom?
Yeah, one of the aspects of value that StepStone brings to this relationship is the ability to identify those managers or GPs who are in the upper quartile, right? And that's the goal, right? Because with private equity, if you're in the lower quartile, you're not outperforming the public markets, right? So how has that been for StepStone in its ability to identify those who are in the upper quartile and bring those folks to Cicera? And has that been, as we've been maturing over time, have those quality managers maintained their quality, or is there a lot of volatility with their year-to-year performance?
So I would expand your comment on the top quartile to even the median. So if you look back at the public market equivalent that we were talking about earlier, for 14 out of the last 15 vintage years, even the private equity median has beat the public market equivalent. So you really need to get into the top two quartiles in order for you to have an outperforming portfolio. And I think generally speaking, in our overall track record, we typically, if we look at sort of the mix of capital, have about 60 to 70% of the capital that we've deployed go into those top two quartiles. So we feel like that's a pretty good edge relative to kind of the overall market.
Yeah, I would say, over the years, we've grown the team quite significantly, over 1,000 employees today, and across all four private market asset classes. So in addition to private equity, private credit, real estate, and infrastructure, I think those other asset classes have been incredibly additive in terms of the full picture that we're seeing, and there's synergies certainly between each asset class, whether it's, you know, working with our private equity managers to provide private credit solutions for their portfolios. And I think that has led to kind of stickier relationships with some of those kind of key core managers. I mean, when we started, I mean, Tom can attest to this, back in 2007, we were an emerging manager ourselves. So many of the relationships that we have today were kind of built from the ground up, you know, both cultivating and bringing relationships from each of our respective backgrounds, but also forming relationships with potentially new and emerging managers that we thought highly of that have grown into large kind of mega funds today that we have very, very close relationships with. So, you know, not all relationships work out, and to your point, the performance, past results is not indicative of future performance, right? But I think a lot of those relationships that we've leaned into have continued to kind of cultivate, good outcomes and generate, you know, pretty positive performance for our clients.
Any other questions for Tom or Natalie? Didn't sound like it. Well, thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Good to see you, as usual.
Thank you. Good to see you, too.
All right. We'll see you next time.